Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. At the get-go, I will apologize. The tree pollen has got me, so I'm pretty scratchy and all of that. But anyway, other than that, before we begin, we need to take a roll call. As everyone knows, Commissioner Morin and Applin are both at the Capitol on agency business and will be here as soon as they can get finished over there. So let's go down the list and everybody declare.
Abel here.
Bell here.
Galo here.
Hildebrand here.
Latimer here.
Hatton here.
Dick Scott here. Okay, this meeting is called to order March 25th, 2021 at 9:30 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Wolf has a statement to make.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items in the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioners, as a reminder, please announce your name before you speak, and please remember to speak slowly for the court reporter. First item is the approval of the minutes from the commission meeting held January 21st, 2021, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Commissioner Bell makes motion for approval.
Second?
Abel, second.
Okay. We'll do a roll call vote again, so all in favor, please say aye.
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 Everybody except
aye.
Commissioner Morin and Applin have voted in favor. Motion carries. Next is an acknowledgement of the list of donations, which has also been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Hatton, motion.
Latimer, second.
Okay, does everybody vote in order here, if you would, please? Commissioner Abel?
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes. Hearing no opposition, motion carries. Next is the consideration of contracts, which have also been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved, Hildebrand.
Hatton, second.
Okay, we'll do the roll call vote again.
Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Hatton, yes.
Scott, yes. Motion carries. Okay, now we get down to the action items. The recommended adoption of these proposed changes in completed rural review, Chapter 57 Fisheries, Chapter 58 Oyster, Shrimp, and Finfish, and Chapter 65 Wildlife. Mr. Murphy, please make your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman. Commissioners, I'm James Murphy, General Counsel for the Department, and I'm here today to present our final set of rules considered for adoption pursuant to the periodic rule review. And next slide, please. Okay, our rule review process is set out in Texas Government Code Section 2001.039. All state agency regulations, also known as rules, must be reviewed no less frequently than once every 4 years. This review must include an assessment of whether the reasons for initially adopting a rule continue to exist. Notice must be published in the Texas Register for public comment, and these rules must be adopted with changes or repealed based upon the review. Next slide, please. Our rule review process is on a chapter-by-chapter basis, usually occurs over three commission meetings. The first meeting, staff notifies the commission of the beginning of the rule review process, is then published in the Texas Register. Second meeting is permission to publish any proposed rule changes in the Texas Register, again, for public comment. And then our third meeting is we seek adoption of any proposed rule changes and repeals. We also at that time seek adoption of the completed rule review, meaning retention of the remaining rules. Next slide, please. Here's our calendar associated with this four-year review cycle. As you can see, we are at the last step of this for the final three chapters. I'm pleased to announce we'll be not doing this for a few years. So next slide, please. We have no proposed changes to Chapter 57 on fisheries, no proposed changes to Chapter 58 on oysters, shrimp, and finfish. Next slide, please. Our first change is to Chapter 65 under wildlife, under subchapter H related to our public lands proclamation. This concerns competitive hunting dog events, field trials, and fees. These are events conducted on parks and wildlife management areas. We have an amendment to require an applicant for a field trial permit to supply a social security number as part of the application process. And then corresponding with that, we're eliminating the requirement that all participators and spectators in the field trial conducted under that permit provide social security numbers. Next slide, please. Our second change is to subchapter O, commercial non-game permits. This is just an amendment to remove an unnecessary internal reference that was caught in the rule review process. Next slide, please. Since this slide was prepared, we've had two additional comments in support for six total. We continue to have one in opposition, but no explanation was provided. Next slide, please. And with that, staff recommends the commission adopt the following motions. Motion 1, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts amendments to Title 31, Texas Administrative Code, Section 65.194, concerning competitive hunting dog event, field trials, and fees, and Section 65.327, concerning commercial non-game permits, with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the February 19, 2021 issue of the Texas Register, cited as 46 Texas Register 1226 and 1230. Second motion, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts the completed rule review of Title 31, Texas Administrative Code, Chapters 57, 58, and 65, as published in the December 18, 2020 issue of the Texas Register, cited as 45 Texas Register 9253, finding that the original reasons for adopting the rules continue to exist as required by Government Code Section 2001.039 and authorizes the publication of a notice of adopted rule review to that effect in the Texas Register. And with that, I've completed my presentation and available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, James. There are no speakers signed up to speak, so any additional comments from the commission or staff? Okay, having none, is there a motion for approval regarding the first motion?
So moved. Table.
Patton, second.
Okay, once again, the roll call vote. Please go down the list.
Gaylor, yes. Bell, yes.
Gaylor, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes. Hearing no opposition, motion carries. Okay, that gets us to action item number two, but before Ken gives his presentation, I have a few words to say. Many of y'all have not been here near as long as I have, and I haven't been here near as long as Ken has. Ken has got 33 years of service and is going to retire. And there's only one person I know for sure that has given more presentations to the commission than Ken, and that, of course, is Ted. But I think I must have heard at least 100. But Ken has done over 114 fishery rule proposals during his career. He probably knows more about inland fishery, more about all the inland fisheries issues than anybody that I know of around here. I mean, he's issued and done so many presentations. It's amazing. He's covered alligator bar, catfish, everything in between. He's past president of both the American Fisheries Society's Texas chapter and the Fisheries Administration section. And he did survive rule proposal questions from Chairman, former Chairman Douglas, which y'all may not be appreciating. Y'all would have had a draft to appreciate that. Ken, congratulations on your retirement and your many years of dedicated service to this agency. It definitely has been appreciated, and you will be missed. Having said that, we'll go to action item 2, the 2021-22 statewide recreational and commercial fishing proclamation, recommended adoption of proposed changes.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Scott, and for your words. It's always been a privilege to come before all the commissioners, and I've always appreciated your dedication to this agency and to doing everything to protect the resource and manage it properly. And as far as Commissioner Duggins, he kept us on our toes, so that's what I'd like to say about him. So with that, good morning, Commissioners. I'm Ken Kruzowski, TPWE's Inland Fisheries Division, and today I'm presenting the proposed changes to freshwater fishing regulations, along with a summary of public comments for your consideration and approval. Next slide, please. Our current statewide regulations for blue and channel catfish consist of a 12-inch minimum length limit and a 25-fish daily bag, which combines both blue and channels. We also have multiple exceptions in place. A team of our biologists over the last 2 years reviewed how we manage catfish. We also used information from previous surveys of anglers and gathered additional input last summer. Anglers told us they want to protect catfish populations but also want to harvest fish. Those were our guideposts for our evaluation of existing regulations. Next slide, please. Our proposal is to remove the 12-inch minimum limit on blues and channels. We would retain the 25-fish combined daily bag limit, but of those 25 fish, anglers could harvest no more than 10 fish 20 inches or longer. Impacts on anglers of the graduated bag restriction will be minimal. From our angler harvest surveys, we know few anglers harvest 25 fish, or even fewer harvest more than 10 catfish over 20 inches. Most anglers said they would rather catch catfish to eat, and this regulation is designed for that, while also providing some protection for larger fish to improve quality and big fish potential. This regulation will be used for most waters statewide. Next slide, please. We received a total of 198 comments on our proposals. On the statewide, those in agreement expressed that this was a good choice to protect the population and allow for a harvest. We did receive a substantial number of comments in disagreement, and most favored more restrictive regulations, even though the proposed new statewide is more restrictive than the current regulation. We do see some benefit to restricting harvest of fish 30 inches or greater, and that we're proposing for the next 12 reservoirs with high-quality catfish populations. We do believe the 10 fish 20 inches or greater bag is more appropriate as a statewide regulation. We have looked at minimum lengths for catfish and do have a few reservoirs currently with no minimum length limits. We were trying to encourage anglers where there was overabundance to harvest some of those smaller fish, but anglers do seem to select for the larger fish 12 inches greater for harvest, so a minimum length limit will have little benefit. Next slide, please. This exception to the statewide regulation for blue and channel catfish, no minimum length limit and 25 bag, but as noted in yellow, modifies the number of fish 20 inches or larger that can be harvested from 10 fish into two categories, 5 fish over 20 inches, and of those, only 1 fish 30 inches or larger. This regulation directs harvest to smaller, easily replaceable fish and protects larger fish while allowing the harvest of one large fish. While it is designed to improve blue catfish populations, it will also maintain quality in channel catfish populations. Next slide, please. We propose 12 locations for this category. In the first column, the six locations that are noted in white are all currently under statewide regulations. In the next column, Kirby and Palestine currently have no minimum length limit of 50 fish bag and a limit of 5 fish over 20 inches. Louisville, Richland Chambers, and Waco are currently under a 35 to 40 inch slot limit, and Tuakini is currently under a 25 bag with limits of 7 fish over 20 and 2 fish over 30. As noted, we received fewer specific comments for these, and those comments were similar to the ones we received for the statewide proposal. Many respondents made similar comments for each of these locations, and we just received a few comments on the complexity of this regulation. Next slide, please. The final proposed exception for blue and channel catfish is a 14-inch minimum length limit and a 15-fish combined daily bag. This regulation will be used to address specific population issues where there are concerns about limited spawning, high harvest, which could damage the population, or to rebuild the population after a catastrophic event such as a fish kill. Next slide, please. All these lakes listed here are currently under statewide regulations. Fewer individuals comment in disagreement for these, about 5 to 6 each, and once again, a few comments on centering on restricting of more harvest of larger fish, and also mentions of restricting the number of jug and trot lines. Next slide, please. We also propose to add 2 large East Texas reservoirs, Lake Livingston and Sam Rayburn Reservoir, with similar catfish populations to an existing regulation category. Livingston currently has a 50 fish bag with a 12 inch minimum, and Rayburn is under statewide rules. This will have the benefit of having 3 Big East Texas reservoirs under the same limits, and some anglers do fish for all 3 of those reservoirs. Next slide, please. We did see a few more individual comments specifically for Livingston, some both for and against commercial fishing on that reservoir. Also mention of a need for minimum length and a few asking about the higher bag limit. Next slide, please. We have a separate section for commercial regulations, so some exceptions that are proposed to be implemented in the areas legal for the sale of catfish will also be listed in the commercial section to be enforceable. This would apply to the Texas-Louisiana border waters, Livingston, Rayburn, and in those smaller lakes with bag limits that limit the harvest to 5 catfish. Individual comments were for or against allowing, once again, some of the comments about commercial fishing. Next slide, please. We propose to standardize float dimensions as length and width rather than height and diameter. We also inadvertently listed the width of the float for minnow traps as 6 inches, and it should be 3 inches. Among the individual comments, there was mention of further restricting these devices and that the float requirement was considered by some to be too onerous. Next slide, please. That concludes my presentation. Based on public comment, the staff would not recommend any changes to our existing proposals. If you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to answer those.
Well, there's nobody signed up to speak, so is there any more comments from the commission or staff? Seeing none,
I need a motion for approval. Commissioner, I believe Dak Eskieslin will make the motion at the end of his proposal as it covers both freshwater and saltwater fisheries.
Okay. We'll wait for that.
You're muted, sir.
You're muted.
Try it again. As a housekeeping matter, back on the first motion, I did not ask for a motion and a second and a vote. So we need to go back and I need a motion To approve that item.
To approve the second motion?
The first motion.
Yes, thank you. This is James Murphy, General Counsel. We're just going back to the second motion on the rule review and getting a first and a second and then all in favor on that, please.
Commissioner Bell seconds.
Okay, let's do the roll call vote again.
Abel, yes. Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes.
Thank you, Commissioners.
So that gets us
to Dacus's presentation.
I'm not sure I follow what Ken was saying. I don't show anybody signed up to speak on that motion on number two.
Mr. Chairman, this is Clayton Wolf. Yes, sir. We've got Mr. Dacus Gieselin is up to handle the coastal proposals on the statewide.
Okay. I don't have that on mine. So if Dax on the line, please give us your proposal.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Dacus Gieselin. I'm in our Coastal Fisheries Division. Today, I'm going to present our statewide saltwater fishing regulation recommendations for adoption and a summary of our public comments received for license year 2022. This includes recommendations for changes regarding crab trap fishing in Aransas Bay and a bag limit clarification item for red snapper. Next slide, please. Current regulations in Aransas Bay include prohibitions of both commercial and recreational use of crab traps. The current regulation prevents waterfront homeowners and shore-based recreational crabbers from fishing for crabs with crab traps from items such as piers or docks and bulkheads. Just as a refresher, our coastwide crab trap regulations include a crab trap limit of 6 traps per licensed user, and you can only fish those traps and actively check those traps during that time from 30 minutes before sunrise to 30 minutes after sunset with no active nighttime fishing. You must also use a valid gear tag attached to a buoy or to a pier. Next slide, please. And this map shows the currently restricted crab trap fishing area indicated in orange. The area begins in the north at Hale Point, extends a half mile from the shoreline, down around Goose Island, past the towns of Rockport and Fulton, and Nine Mile Point, and ending near Tolly Island. Next slide, please. The purpose of our recommendation is to provide an additional opportunity for crab trap fishing from docks, piers, and bulkheads. This is a recreational harvest is expected to be limited. The crab traps must be securely tethered to a fixed object such as a dock, pier, or bulkhead, and this wouldn't include any open water trap fishing. Next slide, please. Our next item is strictly a clarification for red snapper bag limits. As states are authorized to establish season and bag limits for red snapper harvested from federal and state waters, the bag limit in state waters is 4 fish and currently 2 fish in federal waters. Next slide, please. The recommendation would clarify that those 2 red snapper caught in federal waters during the period of time when the federal waters are open count as part of the state bag limit of 4 fish. The intent is to hopefully prevent any confusion amongst anglers that may believe they can catch 2 red snapper from federal waters and then come closer to shore and catch additional 4 red snapper from state waters. Next slide, please. As part of our public scoping process and gathering input, we held a scoping meeting back in early December, followed by a Coastal Resource Advisory Committee in early January, where the committee supported the statewide proposals. And then more recently, we held a public hearing, all done virtually. And through those public venues, we've heard broad-based support to allow recreational crab trap fishing from a fixed structure with a 3-trap limit. We also gathered public input through web portal, email, comments, and phone calls. Next slide, please. And specific to the crab trap item, we received, as of this morning, we actually received 82 comments, so that's an update from the 77, as I talked about yesterday. But that number, that support number, just went up a few percentage points. Of those, we had 8% opposed, and some of the concerns we heard were related to the restriction to fish crab traps from a fixed object, concern over abandoned crab traps, and a perceived negative impact to other recreational opportunities. As you can see, over 30% were neutral on the recommendation. It's worth noting that we also received support from mayors of both Rockport and Fulton, the Aransas County Judge, the Aransas County Navigation District, and although it's not on the slide, we also heard from the Coastal Conservation Association, which did voice its support for both the crab trap item today and the red snapper bag clarification. Next slide, please. In relation to the red snapper bag limit clarification recommendation, we also received 82 comments. As far as support, we saw a little over 67%, just under 19% opposed, with some of the concerns we heard were related to the preference for increased bag limits, matching of federal and state bag limits, and increased enforcement. Right around 13% were neutral on the recommendation. Next slide, please. With that, staff recommends the amendments to the statewide recreational and commercial fishing proclamation as published in the February 19, 2021 issue of the Texas Register. And with that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have some.
Thank you, Dacus. Nobody signed up to speak, so any further comments from the commission or staff? Seeing none, need a motion for approval.
Commissioner Bell makes motion for approval.
Hildebrand second.
Okay, let's do the roll call vote again, please.
Abel, yes. Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes. Hearing no opposition, motion carries. Go on to action item number 3, 2021-22 statewide hunting and migratory game bird proclamations, recommended adoption of proposed changes. So we have three people from staff going to speak. Mr. Gray, Mr. Oldenberger, and Mr. Kane. Would y'all make y'all's presentations, please?
Yes, sir. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Gray, and I'm the Mule Deer and Pronghorn Program Leader. And this morning, I'd like to seek adoption to the proposed pronghorn hunting regulation changes. Next slide, Andrew. As I shared with you yesterday, the Commission adopted new pronghorn regulations in March of 2013 to allow landowners to determine their own harvest strategy for bucks through an experimental system in the Northern Panhandle. This was a novel approach when it comes to pronghorn management, as in other areas, we use a limited quota system where permits are issued to landowners. Therefore, these regulations were proposed and adopted as a pilot project. In March of 2017, the commission expanded and extended the experimental system for another 4 years because staff believed that more data were needed over a larger area to better examine the impacts of the experiment. DPWD has conducted this pilot project over the last 8 hunting seasons, and staff have monitored populations through annual aerial surveys and mandatory harvest check stations. Staff have also used hunter and landowner opinion surveys to evaluate support for continuing and expanding the experimental system. Next slide, Andrew. Staff believed after the experiment, if data suggested minimal or no decline in pronghorn numbers, sex ratios, average buck age structure, and hunter success, then no negative biological impacts would occur with a landowner-controlled system for bucks. Next slide. Again, this is the map that demonstrates our current pronghorn herd units in the northern panhandle. In the herd units in red, we initiated in 2013, and the herd units in blue, we initiated the experimental system in 2017. Next slide, please. The data that I shared with you yesterday and in previous meetings indicate that the experimental concept seemed to have little to no impact on pronghorn population sustainability. However, the intensive buck harvest for 8 hunting seasons has had a negative impact on buck age structure and sex ratios within the experimental areas. With impacts to buck age structure and fewer bucks on the landscape, hunter satisfaction is decreasing, but hunters still like the concept. This is contrasted to landowners whose satisfaction and support for the experimental concept are declining. When given the option, the majority of landowners prefer a 16-day season with TPWD issuing permits and setting quotas over a 9-day season using the experimental concept. Next slide. Staff have intensively monitored populations and proposed to cancel the experimental season for bucks in the northern panhandle based upon excessive buck harvest causing younger buck age structure and more skewed sex ratios. In addition, the opinion survey showed that landowner and hunter satisfaction has decreased within the experimental areas, as well as landowner support for continuing in the current areas or expanding the season to new areas. Also, when given a choice, the majority of landowners would rather use a 16-day season with TPWD setting quotas than the 9-day season with the experimental concept. Staff also proposed to extend the current season from 9 days to 16 days statewide, since staff issues pronghorn permits to set harvest quotas for each property, and that most hunters and landowners in the November opinion survey liked a 16-day season better than a 9-day season. For the 1-week extension, staff proposed the season be changed to start the Saturday closest to October 1, which is the current opening, and continue for 16 consecutive days based upon the high response rate and opinions of landowners, since there are no concrete biological reasons on where this extension should occur. Next slide, please. Again, we've had just a few more public comments since the slide was created, but the public comments made online so far have indicated that 76% of the respondents agreed with the statewide hunting proclamation proposal, with only 5% disagreeing completely. There were 16 germane comments disagreeing with the with extending the pronghorn season from 9 days to 16 days. And these commenters were mostly from the Trans-Pecos and more specifically from Hudspeth County. And I'll just take a little bit of time here to kind of talk about Hudspeth County. There's a portion of Hudspeth County that has some outstanding pronghorn habitat and is what we call the land of Boone and Crockett pronghorn. Every year, there's Boone and Crockett pronghorn harvested in this area. And in fact, our state record was harvested in this area. And so, yesterday I had a couple of phone calls from two landowners that are within this area, and these landowners are great friends of the department. And our local biologist, Jose Etchart, has done a phenomenal job working with these landowners and other landowners in Hudspeth and Culberson counties on all things pronghorn, from it being harvest management, habitat management, research, and even predator management. And I just wanted to make sure that I brought their concerns forward. And those concerns, again, like I said yesterday, were they believe that the 9 days were long enough to hunt pronghorn, and the extra week they thought would put too much stress on animals, and that TPWD does not have biological justification to extend the season. Next slide, please. And so this concludes my portion of the statewide hunting regulations. I'd be happy to address any questions that you might have on these proposed pronghorn changes before I turn it over to Sean Oldenberger.
Any questions? I don't believe we have any. So, Sean, you're up.
Good morning, Chairman and fellow commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Oldenberger. Today we'll be presenting proposed changes to the Statewide Hunting Proclamation and the Migratory Game Bird Proclamation. And we'll just wait here a few seconds for the next slide to come up. Next slide, Andrew. First, we're going to start with proposed changes to the upland game bird regulations. Next slide, Andrew. First, we'll talk about a fairly simplification of current regulations regards to plain chachalaca hunting in the Lower Rio Grande Valley. We do have a few counties open to this species. As I mentioned yesterday, this is a species where we're at the northern range of it. This species goes about two-thirds the way south into South America. Very widespread upland game bird, but only hunted in the United States and the Lower Rio Grande Valley. Staff recommend to change the opening day for chachalacas to align with the quail opening date. This would be the Saturday nearest November 1st, which is the current regulation, and moving that to Saturday nearest October 28th. So just a simplification of regulations and make those seasons concurrent. Next slide, please. The next proposed change by staff would be to close spring eastern turkey season in Panola County. This has met the decision variables for closure as in past closures with counties in East Texas. On average, less than one bird has been reported harvest over the past three spring seasons. And just as a reminder for commissioners, this is mandatory reporting harvest in these counties due to our current work in the department to restore this population and to better understand populations and harvest. There is fewer than 50,000 contiguous acres occupied by wild turkeys in this county. That's based on occupancy surveys done by our TPWD biologists in the field. Next slide, please. Just to look at harvest in Panola County over the last 20 years, you can see the graph in front of you. We generally consider basically harvest to be linear with population size in these counties with eastern wild turkeys. You can see there in the early 2000s, in 2001, we harvested 14 wild turkeys during the season, and then it bumped back up in 2005 to about 16 individuals harvested. However, since then, harvest has basically linearly declined to the point where in 2018 and 2019 there were no birds harvested. So this indicates a population decline in this county. Therefore, staff are recommending to close season next year in Panola County during the spring only season. Next slide, please. Moving on to the next proposed changes, once again with wild turkeys. This has to do with what we call our one western gobbler counties. You can see the map in front of you. That has two areas shaded in gray, the ones along the Red River and along the Louisiana border. Those are eastern wild turkey spring counties that are open. And then we have in the darker gray, those are our western one gobbler counties in south central Texas. That is a season that occurs from April 1st to April 30th. You're only allowed one harvest of one bird per county in this in these counties. We're asking for mandatory reporting for the fact we get very limited information on harvest with our small game harvest survey. I mentioned yesterday, for instance, in Bastrop County, which tends to be our better habitat within these counties, we may get of those 25,000 people we randomly select for the survey, we may be lucky enough to get one every 3 years to report a harvest in Bastrop County. So therefore, staff have really limited information on harvest. Therefore, we can't really make any recommendations on how to move forward with any either restrictions, further restrictions, or further liberalizations in these counties. We do have support from wildlife management associations and wildlife cooperatives in these respective counties in the past. And most counties in question recently transitioned to white-tailed deer reporting requirements during the doe days that started last year. And so, once again, this was to be with the My Texas Hunt Harvest app or going online would be the two ways to mandatory report these harvests in these counties. Next slide, please. Moving on to the next wild turkey proposed change by staff. This would be to align the north and south turkey zone boundary to be consistent across spring and fall seasons. This was a commission request a few years ago, and just allow that fall, following that fall boundary along Highway 90. This would impact 26 counties, with some of them moving into the north zone and some of them moving to the south zone. But once again, this biologically makes sense. It simplifies regulations based on research that we actually did in the 1980s through 1990s. And we actually find that those current counties north of 90 currently in the south zone open a little early. So this would actually allow a lot more female turkeys to get bred during this time of the year and get on nest before we actually open hunting season. Next slide, please. Moving on to the last proposed change by staff with small game program with the statewide hunting proclamation. This once again presented this yesterday during the work session. The two maps in front of you are basically citizen science collected data through iNaturalist. The one on the right is where locations of basically fox squirrels have been located through citizen science. And the one on the left is where gray squirrels have been located, and those are reported. We actually seen both squirrel populations expand outside of the historic range in Texas. We currently have 46 closed counties in the state of Texas. So for simplification and with regards to a few requests we've occurred in the Panhandle and even the Trans-Pecos in the last few years would be to open those counties and just make sure those counties have consistent regulations with open year-round with no daily bag limit. These counties, there's not a biological concern because this isn't traditional squirrel habitat. This may expand hunter harvest opportunity somewhat, but not substantially. We do see even harvest into the rolling plains, and so some of those counties are adjacent to where we do see current harvest through our small game harvest survey. So once again, just a simplification of regulations to basically expand squirrel hunting statewide where that opportunity may exist in the future. Next slide, please. As far as public comment with regards to these changes in the statewide hunting proclamation, we did receive a very minimal comment. We did have some folks that recommended the turkey change years ago with regards to the north and south line. And also we did receive a number of email comments regarding supporting of open squirrel hunting in the closed counties. Next slide, please. We'll move on to proposed staff changes during the 21-22 Migratory Game Bird Proclamation. Next slide, please. Basically, we have no federal framework changes from this last hunting season, so therefore staff recommend to maintain season lengths and daily bag limits from this previous season because of no changes by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're also recommending calendar progression for season dates for all migratory game bird seasons. So basically, no proposed changes with migratory game bird regulations except one. Next slide, please. We did request last year to the Fish and Wildlife Service to expand our special whiteling dove days in the south zone. You can see the map in front of you actually shows the zones across the state of Texas with the north, central, and south zone. We did expand the special white-winged dove days to the entire south zone a few years ago. And basically, what we're going to propose to do is go from that four-day afternoon-only season to a six-day afternoon-only season. Next slide, please. Looking at the staff recommended changes to the special white-winged dove days on a calendar, you can see the proposed changes for next year, with gray being the regular season. Once again, a reminder for commissioners, we can only open the regular season as early as September 14th by federal frameworks under Fish and Wildlife Service. However, you can see there in what would be the traditional proposed days for the special white-winged dove days in yellow, being September 4th, 5th, the 11th, and 12th. We are basically proposing to add those two extra days to Saturday the 3rd on that Friday, and then the following Friday on the 10th to allow folks a long three-day weekend possibility for hunting if they choose to select that. That seems to be the simplest way to move forward with the 6 days. Future calendars will probably be a little bit more difficult to look at, but this year this is an easy proposed change. And as the chairman asked yesterday, we did have to pull those days off the regular season because we're only allowed 90 dove days for harvest underneath federal regulations. And so we did pull those days at the end of January, where we really have very limited dove hunting opportunities still occurring in January. There are still plenty of doves around. It's just most folks have moved on to other things by that time in January as far as hunting. And so we do see limited opportunity occur during those days. Next slide, please. As far as public comment on the Migratory Game Bird Proclamation, we basically have seen no change since yesterday's slide. We did have 27 people comment online. 22 of the 27 agreed completely. We did have 5 disagree specifically on a number of items. Next slide, please. Basically, public comment was we did have support too for the 2 additional special white-winged dove days, but disagreed specifically on wanted to open the south zone duck season with deer season, eliminate the split and open later in south zone, open the south zone duck season earlier. And so you can see there wherever you're on the map in that large south zone, whether you're in Port Mansfield or in the Chenier Plain, you have different opinions in that south zone. And so that seems to be the largest public comment, that it was only a few. And then the other proposed public comments were suggestions outside of federal frameworks or WMA regulations, for instance, wanting to have a duck season in February, which is not allowed by federal law. Next slide, please. And with that, that concludes my presentation, and I'll be happy to take any questions before I turn it over to Mr. Alan Kane.
Any questions?
I've got one, Hildebrand, Commissioner Hildebrand. You talked about a data collection process by the general public. I think it was referencing the squirrel, sightings of squirrels. What's the methodology? How does one actually identify the squirrel and then get it into some database? I'm just curious as to how you guys recover that information.
Yeah, and so that's in iNaturalist is the program. I think Tanya is on the later on to actually discuss that program with iNaturalist and some of the stuff we do in urban areas as well across the state. But once again, it's just an application that's on your phone. You can take pictures of various things. You submit them online through online or actually through your phone. And then people review those for, say, research grade or other if you have pictures. And it's just built a database of basically where those species occur occupancy-wise across the state and across the nation and across the world. Citizen science has become very important through data collection to us as wildlife biologists as well. We do have a limited number of staff, and so whenever we can use the public and their data collection to support regulation changes one way or the other, we obviously look at those opportunities, and this is just another one. But I believe that will be explained a little bit further and with more detail and more expertise than I can to Commissioner later on.
Great. Thank you. When we hear the presentation, I'd like to know how many downloads of this iNaturalist do we find in the state of Texas, and how widely used, and is it being disseminated? Because I had not heard of it before. So anyway, I'll wait for the full presentation.
All right. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay, any further comments? Okay, Alan, you're up.
Thank you. While Andrew's getting my slide up, good morning, commissioners. For the record, I'm Alan Kane, Whitetail Deer Program Leader, and this morning I'll be seeking adoption of several proposed changes to statewide big game harvest regulations. Next slide, Andrew, please. So the first change being proposed is a minor housekeeping change to include the crossbow and the definition of lawful archer equipment. The current definition includes longbow, recurve bow, and compound bow. However, in the archery section under lawful means, the regulation refers to lawful archer equipment and crossbows rather than a single reference to all legal archery equipment, simply an artifact left over from a time when crossbows were added as a legal means to take during the archery season, but the lawful archery equipment definition wasn't changed to include crossbows at that time. Next, please, Andrew. And so in order to simplify the regulation and provide some clarity as it relates to lawful archery equipment, staff are proposing to include crossbows in the definition. Next, please. Next slide. The next change being proposed is a modification of the definition of a muzzleloader. The current definition defines a muzzleloader as any firearm that's loaded through the muzzle, but that definition is ambiguous on what must be loaded through the muzzle. Well, that's the bullet or projectile, or does that require the powder to be loaded as well? This lack of clarity in the regulation leads to questions by hunters and others as to what's considered a legal muzzleloader in Texas, especially with changes and enhancements to the current muzzleloading technology. And so with the direction from the commission at yesterday's meeting, staff are proposing to amend the definition to clarify that a bullet or projectile and powder can only be loaded through the muzzle. Again, amending this definition would remove any uncertainty for hunters and firearm manufacturers or others as to what's legal and not legal in Texas with regards to muzzleloaders. And I'll just mention that we will work with legal to make sure we have the correct terminology to describe powder appropriately and make sure that works. Next. And then the next change being proposed involves the trailing of wounded deer or dogs in 10 East Texas counties. Over the last several years, staff continued to receive requests to allow the use of dogs to recover wounded deer in these 10 counties. And after further review, staff no longer consider illegal dog hunting to be an issue or a resource concern in these counties. Therefore, staff are proposing to completely remove the prohibition in 6 counties, those in green, which include Angelina, Hardin, Nacogdoches, Orange, Shelby, and Tyler counties. And then those counties in yellow, which include Jasper, Newton, Sabine, and St. Augustine, staff are proposing to allow trailing of wounded deer with no more than 2 dogs on a leash. Next slide. To date, we received 176 public comments from the website, and this includes all the statewide proposals, statewide hunting regulation proposals, not just specific to the proposals I just reviewed. We've also had a handful of comments via email, and we did hold a public hearing Zoom meeting on March 16th, and it had 38 participants. And of those that provided comment on the website, we had 68 with written comments. Next, please, Andrew. And so those that disagreed with the dog hunting portion of the proposal were concerned about, you know, that the proposal would result in resurgence of dog hunting or trespassing issues. We had one individual that commented that would like to see trailing of wounded deer with dogs or all dogs be on a leash in all counties in the state. And then we have another individual opposed to the proposal and actually wanted to liberalize it to allow up to 3 dogs to recover deer and remove the lease restriction in those four counties that I mentioned. Next, please. With regards to muzzleloaders and crossbows, most of the comments were favorable to the proposal, but one commenter recommended that muzzleloaders be defined by the use of black powder rather than smokeless powder. Another commenter suggested muzzleloaders be restricted to the more traditional flintlock or percussion style. And with regards to crossbows, those comments that disagreed with the proposal simply did not support the use of crossbows during archery seasons as a legal means to take, and these were more traditionalist in what they believe legal archery equipment was, but really it's not germane to the proposal since crossbows are already legal as a means to take during the archery season. And so this is simply a language cleanup for that particular part of the proposal. And next, please. So staff are recommending the adoption of the following amendments with modifications to the muzzleloader language as necessary to 31 TAC in Chapter 65.3, 65.11, 65.19, 65.30, 65.32, 65.40, 65.42, 65.46, 65.64, and 65.66 concerning the statewide hunting proclamation, and amendments to Chapter 65.314 through 65.320 concerning the Migratory Game Bird Proclamation, which changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the February 19th, 2021 issue of the Texas Register. So that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
This is Commissioner Abel. I'd like to make one request. We got into some discussion yesterday, you know, trying to define what a muzzleloader was. You showed us a slide that had four different types. I remember the first two being flintlock and percussion. I can't remember how the second two were defined. But I'd like to ask the department to do a little research and give us some information as far as what percentage of muzzleloader hunters are using what I would call a classic muzzleloader, you know, being the first two, probably with no optic, versus the second two. Just with the thought in mind that I think the original intent was that, you know, of giving the extra 2 weeks of the season for muzzleloader hunting was that it was more challenging. And so I think we might want to look at whether that's the case, you know, if whether the second two types of muzzleloaders, you know, that have a break breech and an optic are truly more challenging than a modern sporting rifle. And to that end, we probably ought to do the same thing with, you know, figuring out what percentage of people are using sort of an advanced crossbow with an optic and laser. And there again, you know, should that be allowed in an archery-only season?
We can certainly circle back around with our team and investigate the best we can. That'd be a challenge, but I think we can.
Yeah, I'm not proposing to change anything about today's recommendation. I just would like to have a little more information going forward, whether those are things that we might further define.
Sure.
Okay, any further discussion? There's nobody signed up to speak. So if there aren't any more comments from the commission or staff, I'd like a motion to approve this.
Commissioner Latimer so moves.
Abel, second.
Okay, well, we'll do our roll call vote again, please.
Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes. Motion carries. That gets us to action item number 4, acceptance of donation of land, Fort Bend County, approximately 300 acres at Brazos Bend State Park. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth, please.
Commissioners, good Good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. Delighted to be bringing this item to you this morning. This is the result of a long, friendly relationship with a neighbor at Brazos Bend State Park. Next slide. As I think all of you know, Brazos Bend State Park is in southeast Texas, not very far from the sprawling suburbs of South Houston. Next slide. Because of its proximity to several million people, it is visited by a quarter of a million people a year now. Again, it's a very, very popular park, one of our crown jewel state parks, I would argue. Next slide. We acquired it in 1976. It now consists of almost 5,000 acres, a couple of miles of frontage on the Brazos River. The majority of it is bottomland hardwood forest, although there are some nice remnant tall grass coastal prairies and just a variety of wetlands, abundant wildlife. The park is probably most noted for its alligators. Anybody on almost any day can go to the park and get a look at a big alligator. And the park is again, just very popular for a variety of day uses and for wildlife watching. Next slide. Joe Wessendorf owned a ranch to the north, on the north side of the park, at the west end of the park, a little over 300 acres. His ranch included the north 100 acres of a 900-acre lake called Pilot Lake, an old oxbow lake of the river. In addition, he excavated out a 12-acre lake. His property has been relatively well maintained. The coastal forests are intact. He has about 100 acres of coastal prairie, which have been largely converted to improved pasture, but which would be will lend themselves well to being restored back to the historic tall grass prairie. Mr. Wessendorf passed away a few years ago. He left the real property of his estate to the Henderson Wessendorf Foundation with the instruction that his ranch at Brazos Bend was to be donated to the department for addition to the state park. Next slide. And you can see in this map where that lies in relation to the park. You can kind of make out the tan kidney bean-shaped Pilot Lake. You can tell that the north end of that is included. You can also see that gives us additional frontage and access to the areas north of the lake that are otherwise very difficult to get to from the county road. And again, just a tremendous asset both for its conservation values and the recreational opportunities it would add to the state park at a time when the visitation is steadily growing. And, of course, Houston is getting closer and closer all the time. Next slide, please. We've received 8 responses. All are in support of adding acreage to Brazos Bend State Park. Next slide. Staff does recommend that you adopt a motion today. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to accept the donation of approximately 300 acres in Fort Bend County for addition to Brazos Bend State Park. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from anybody? Hearing none, and there are no speakers signed up to speak. Need a motion for approval, please.
Commissioner Galo moves to adopt the motion.
Hildebrand second.
Okay, let's do our roll call vote again, please.
Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Scott, yes. Billy had stepped out. So, hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Moves on to action item number 5. Grant of drainage easement, Hidalgo County, approximately 1 acre, at the Estero Llano Grande State Park. Ted, you're up again.
Commissioners, good morning again. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is an item that you heard in January. You asked the staff to gather some more information and do a little more homework, which we've done. So we're back to request action on this item. Next slide. This is involves a drainage project that at the city of Westlake that would include the Estero Llano Grande State Park, which is one of the three World Birding Centers in the lower Rio Grande Valley. This one's in Hidalgo County. Next slide. And although this slide says 2 miles south of Westlake, the city of Westlake reaches almost to the World Birding Center. The World Birding Center State Park is surrounded by ag lands and new urban development or suburban development. Next slide. This is an outline of the state park. The long, narrow water body on the south is the Llano Grande. The inholdings are remnant RV spots, which are systematically being added to the state park and eliminated. Next slide. Right now, the park consists of 230 acres of native thorn forest and a variety of wetlands, including emergent marshes and ponds. It attracts an incredible variety of birds due to that combination of native habitats. Well over 300 species of birds have been documented. The site is quite the destination for bird watchers from around the country and quite frankly, from around the world because of the variety of birds that can be regularly and dependably seen there at the at that World Birding Center. Next slide. The city, which is immediately north and essentially is upstream from the state park as it grows, has experienced increasing issues with trying to get rid of water especially during these tropical storms, which are not all that uncommon in the valley. And the city has maintained a series of drainage canals since the early 20th century, one of which runs right through the state park. And they regularly maintain these canals, including the one in the state park. They would like to increase the drainage of the city with some improvements in the city, including retention ponds and enlarging the profiles of some of those drainage features in the city. They anticipate that this will increase the amount of water entering the state park, and so they would like to replace the round culverts under an adjacent county road and the park entrance road with larger profile box culverts, and they would like to add riprap. They'd like to go ahead and clean out those canals again as they do periodically and add riprap to minimize any scouring that might occur with the increased flow of water. Next slide. The footprint of the area that they would like access to is largely within easements. They already exist. The easements, because they're well over 100 years old, are difficult to really map out and get an exact footprint. The city requests and park staff and department staff agree that it would be advantageous for the city and for the department to go ahead and more carefully codify their easement rights to enter the park and continue maintaining those canals, as well as their right to install that riprap and those culverts. We have looked carefully at the change in flood elevations that would occur as a result of the drainage project. We do not believe there is any increased risk to park infrastructure. There may be an increase in ponding time, retention time, in the park, and as a result, we've asked the city to agree to install a pump station at the extreme, at the outfall for that drainage canal that would allow them to move water much more quickly out of the park and into the Llano Grande. but it would also allow them to take water during lower flow events and pump it from the canal up into the parks, ponds, and marshes. That water is currently purchased from the irrigation district, and we believe that the pump station would reduce our operating costs by making that water or making water available to us at other times of the year at no cost. So we believe this is a win-win situation, both for the city and their need to improve drainage and for our need to keep our wetlands hydrated. Next slide. You can see in this map where the area is of the proposed easement in the northwest corner of the park. You can see in blue the existing irrigation canal or drainage canal, which again has been there for well over a century. And you can see where that pump station would be that would pump water out of the park and into the Llano Grande. Next slide. And this is just a close-up of that area where they would like to add the culverts and the riprap to control, again, any potential for erosion that might occur with increased flows into the park. Next slide. We received two responses, one in support and one in opposition. The one in opposition just felt like there are other tools that can be brought to bear to help deal with runoff water from the city. Next slide. Staff does recommend that the commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the commission? Okay, since there's nobody lined up to speak, would entertain a motion for approval.
Abel, so moved.
Patton, second.
Okay, let's do our roll call vote again, please.
Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Gaylo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes. Motion carries. Okay, that gets us to action item number 6, disposition of land, Harrison County, approximately 7 acres at the Caddo Lake Wildlife Management Area. You up again, Ted.
Commissioners, good morning again. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is a second reading of this item. You heard it in January. Next slide, please. This involves one of our boundary areas within the Caddo Lake Wildlife Management Area. The wildlife management area actually straddles two counties, but this specific boundary that we're concerned about is in Harrison County. Next slide. As you can see, Caddo Lake and Wildlife Management Area are associated facilities for the department, and they're about 20 miles northeast of Marshall in extreme East Texas. Next slide. Caddo Lake itself covers almost 27,000 acres. Actually, depending upon the rainfall, it varies quite a bit. But the wildlife management area covers almost 9,000 acres today and is best known for its cypress swamps, but also consists of bios, a variety of marshes and other types of wetlands, some open water, bottomland forests, uplands, transitional habitats between those open water habitats and uplands, a very, very popular hunting destination for deer, hogs, waterfowl, also popular for wildlife watching. Next slide. So we actually began acquiring land at Caddo Lake in the 1930s with the formation of the state park, which was a CCC park. But because the resource is so special and so unique and so Texan, we began adding land in earnest in the 1980s and 90s, and we sprawled over onto the north side of Caddo Lake, which created issues, management issues for state park staff. So in 1997, we took the acreage that we had acquired on the north side of Caddo Lake and turned it into a wildlife management area, which again now consists of almost 9,000 acres. Dozens of transactions over the years have resulted in the current configuration of the wildlife management area. One of those transactions was the residue of a subdivision which was primarily intended to provide people with waterfront homes, canalfront homes, lakefront homes, access to the lake, called Cypress Village. And once most of those lots were sold, arrangements were made to transfer the remaining lots to the department. Next slide. You can tell in this map where that Cypress Lake subdivision is in relationship to the rest of the wildlife management area. Next slide. The problem with this conveyance is that some of those tracks actually provided access to roads. Some of them provided some connectivity between units. But some of them were actually sandwiched, if not surrounded, by private lands, which has resulted in a very convoluted boundary. And it's been almost impossible to keep those boundaries marked and to keep adjacent landowners from trespassing, in some cases just inadvertently, and in other cases I believe folks just felt like no one had ever noticed that they had put a subject field or a fence or a part of a building onto adjacent undeveloped property. And so it become quite a time-consuming effort for staff at the WMA to keep an eye on those lots and to try and minimize those trespass issues. Today, most of those lots have mobile homes or cabins or fish camps on them. Next slide. Again, just the odd configuration of that land and the amount of boundary in common with adjacent landowners and the tiny size of some of those adjacent lots has just resulted in a constant stream of trespass issues that really are more of a liability than an asset for the department. Next slide. And this is just a visual image of what that subdivision and what that area looks like. Next slide. And this is a map. The pale blue lots are those lots that were already sold, most of which, again, have structures on them. Some people live there full time. Some have those as weekend places or seasonal places. The lots in dark blue are the lots we would propose to keep, again, because they provide access to roads or because they're adjacent enough or connected enough to what we own that they make sense to continue managing for their conservation value. The lots in the bright pink are for the most part surrounded by private property. They are the lots that have caused us a great deal of time and effort to try and monitor and work with the adjacent landowners to minimize and prevent trespass, not always successfully. 17 lots in total. The proposal would be to sell those at or above current market value. In many cases, adjacent landowners have already expressed an interest in acquiring those from us at market value, and then to take those funds and use them to acquire property that really would contribute to our mission and really would make good sense from a conservation and recreation standpoint. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. And this is just a close-up of... And you saw the close-up yesterday. So we have received four responses. Three are in opposition. In this slide, again, you can just see that we had four responses. Those that were in opposition just all said the same thing, which was that we should never part with land that's been added to a wildlife management area or a state park. One made the comment that if we did part with land, we should take those proceeds and use them to acquire more land with higher value, which, of course, is the plan and is statutorily required for land sale proceeds anyway. So this was the comments we received. Next slide. And the staff does recommend that the commission adopt this motion this morning. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from anybody?
Commissioner Hildebrand, so clearly we need to sell the property for fair market value and or above, and seems like a very elegant solution to, you know, a complicated issue. But are you going to give, and I don't know if you can do this via state law, but do you give some preference to the contiguous landowner? Because it seems as though they should have kind of first shot to be a good neighbor. So any thoughts on that? And then secondly, is this the area where they were doing the shade tree dredging operation with a backhoe on a barge? Is this the same, if I recall?
Yes, sir. The slide that we kind of skipped over actually included those tracks that had the homemade canal across them. And to your first point, 15 years ago, this slide, in fact, you can even see in that sort of northeast portion, those three pink tracks, you can see the shadow of that canal that was dredged across these. So yes, sir, that's a good example of the kind of issue that we've fought over the years. But to your first point, probably 15 years ago, the commission directed the staff to prepare a land policy for dispositions and instructed us to make it very clear that preference would be given to adjacent landowners. So our procedure is that we work with a local broker, and we have a local broker in this case who has been a tremendous friend of the wildlife management area and has helped us add lands to the wildlife management area at no cost for his services for 20 years now. And to get a fair market value on those, to bump it up a notch, and then to offer it to specifically offer it to the adjacent landowner first, and then if they decline to purchase, then we go open market with those. But yes, sir, to your point, the commission felt 15 years ago and has signaled regularly that they feel like that's a good faith way to deal with our neighbors and work with our neighbors in cases where we are getting rid of land.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Well, if that's the case, there's no speaker signed up, so need a motion to approve.
So moved, Hildebrand.
Second, Galo.
Okay, let's do our roll call vote again, please.
Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes. Motion carries. So that gets us to action item number 7, and our chairman has gotten here, so I'm assuming that you're gonna do it.
All right. Well, thank you for running the meeting this morning, and it looks like we've made good progress. I'll move into action item number 7, land acquisition strategy, Bastrop County, approximately 150 acres of Bastrop State Park. Mr. Trey Vick.
Thank you, commissioners. For record, my name's Trey Vick. I'm with the Land Conservation Program, and I'll be presenting today a land acquisition strategy in Bastrop County, approximately 150 acres at Bastrop State Park. Next slide, Andrew, please. Bastrop State Park is located in Bastrop County. Next slide. It sits approximately 32 miles southeast of Austin. Next slide, please. Bastrop State Park now consists of approximately 7,200 acres. It's a significant example of the Lost Pines ecosystem. The state acquired a good portion of the park in the 30s from private owners in the city of Bastrop. The CCC constructed the earliest park facilities. Bastrop being so close to the Austin area is an extremely popular destination for Central Texans for hiking, birding, and camping. Next slide, please. Park staff has an interest in negotiating the acquisition of several tracts of land totaling approximately 150 acres, all from willing sellers. This is contingent upon the commission's authorization. These strategic acquisitions are all located adjacent to the park and have been identified as top priorities by staff and state park management. Acquisition of these tracts would allow for future public use. It'll protect that Lost Pines ecosystem, protect critical habitat, and would just be a good add-on to Bastrop State Park. Next slide, please. Here's a general map of the park itself and an outline of adjacent tracks, that area that we're going to be targeting. Next slide, please. As of this morning, we'd received a total of 11 comments, 10 in support and 1 in opposition. Next slide, please. And staff recommends that the Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorized the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire several strategic tracts of land totaling approximately 150 acres in Bastrop County for addition to Bastrop State Park. Next slide, please. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any discussion by the commission? No one has signed up to speak. Therefore, I'll entertain a motion for approval.
Commissioner Galo moves to adopt.
Second, Commissioner Scott.
Second. Commissioner Bell, second. Thank you very much. Again, we're going to go through the roll call. I vote yes.
Ashlyn, yes. Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Patton, yes.
Scott, yes.
And hearing none, hearing no opposition, the motion carries.
Thank
Action
you.
Item number... Eight, thank you very much for your presentation. Action item number 8, acquisition of land, Anderson County, approximately 430 acres at the Big Lake Bottom Wildlife Management Area. Mr. Jason Estrella, please make your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Jason Estrella with the Land Conservation Program. And this morning I'll be presenting on a land acquisition in Anderson County, approximately 430 acres at the Big Lake Bottom Wildlife Management Area. Next slide, please. The Big Lake Bottom Wildlife Management Area is located in southwest Anderson County. Next slide, please. It's along the Trinity River, approximately 10 miles southwest of Palestine. Next slide, please. The WMA comprises approximately 3,900 acres, again, along the Trinity River, and is a part of the Middle Trinity River Ecosystem Project. The WMA was acquired to preserve a relic tract of bottomland hardwood habitat within the Post Oak Savannah region beginning around 1990. Currently, the WMA is utilized for hunting, fishing, several non-consumptive recreational activities, and to facilitate research and demonstrations in a manner compatible with protection and management of WMA resources. Next slide, please. The subject tract is an adjacent, approximately 430-acre tract and has been a high-priority acquisition for the department for many years. Acquisition would clean up the boundary of the central area of the WMA, which you'll see shortly, would provide an additional 2 miles of frontage on the Trinity River, along with additional recreational opportunities. Staff had reason to believe that the property was going to be placed on the open market and had requested the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation secure the property under contract to preserve the opportunity for TPWD's acquisition. Recently, the foundation has worked closely with the estate and presented them with a contract that the estate is currently considering. Acquisition is a contingent upon the authorization from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission. Next slide, please. As you can see, the subject tract in yellow, except for the Trinity River, which flows along the southern boundary, the tract is surrounded by the WMA, as you can see there in red. Next slide, please. To date, we have received 10 responses, all in support, the consensus being any opportunity to acquire public land for recreational and conservation opportunities is a positive thing. Next slide, please. So staff recommends that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire approximately 430 acres in Anderson County for addition to Big Lake Bottom Wildlife Management Area. Next slide, please. And I will be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Jason. Is there any discussion by the commission? No one has signed up to speak. So I entertain a motion for approval. Do I have a motion?
Commissioner Latimer.
Commissioner Latimer, do I have a second?
Jason, second.
I'm sorry, who seconded it?
Neither.
Thank you very much. Again, we'll do the roll call. I vote yes.
Applin, yes.
Abel, yes.
Bell, yes.
Galo, yes.
Hildebrand, yes.
Latimer, yes.
Hatton, yes.
Scott, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. The motion, no one's opposed. The motion passes. Moving on to briefing item number 9, the Texas Nature Trackers Program and the City Nature Challenge. Dr. Tanya Homayoun, please make your presentation. I may not have said that right.
No, sir, you have that correct.
Oh, good.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Tanya Homayoun, Texas Nature Trackers Biologist with the Wildlife Division. Today, I'm going to be talking about our experiences using the City Nature Challenge event to rally interest and participation in community science supporting the agency's conservation work in Texas. Next slide, please. The Texas Nature Trackers program engages naturalists of all ability levels and interests in community science data collection focused on native plants and animals. The program offers opportunities that both grow and enrich the naturalist community and generate data that contribute to research and inform conservation decisions. One of the particular goals of the program is to collect data on Texas species of greatest conservation need. Today, most Nature Trackers projects are hosted on the iNaturalist platform. This is available both online via website and via mobile app and in multiple languages. And it's part biodiversity database and part social network. Users can create a free account and upload observations that are anchored by photos or sound files, which the rest of the community can then use to suggest identifications. One of the benefits is that this means people can enter at any knowledge level. Next slide, please. Currently, we manage 12 long-term taxonomic projects in iNaturalist, as well as projects targeting specific conservation issues. We also use iNaturalist to host BioBlitzes, which are nature censuses that create a snapshot of biodiversity for a specific place and time, which is a great means of engaging a broader audience who might just be starting out as naturalists. Next slide, please. The ultimate goal is to use the iNaturalist projects as community science data inputs to the Natural Diversity Database, our statewide database of record for natural resources, where they'll supplement data from our biologists, researchers, and contractors and be used to assist with on-the-ground conservation decision-making. Since its creation, one of our projects, the Herps of Texas iNaturalist Project, has generated a current total of 4,900 records for tracked herp species that have been added to or updated in the Natural Diversity Database. Next slide, please. As the core of community scientists in Texas grows, the Nature Trackers program offers multiple levels of engagement. We invite new community scientists to join entry-level BioBlitzes and from there grow their interests and abilities to a place where they generate high-quality data for our long-term taxonomic projects. More experienced community scientists can join advanced projects such as assisting with field research, designing and executing camo trapping projects, and supporting curation of our long-term projects. Next slide, please. One challenge we face is the reality of Texas as a rapidly urbanizing state, with more than 85% of our population now living in or around a major metro area. How do we successfully engage urban and suburban Texans with natural resource monitoring and stewardship in a way that's relevant to them and impactful to the agency's work? Next slide, please. We had the opportunity a couple of years ago to get involved with the City Nature Challenge, which is a global city-scale BioBlitz event that frames an urban biodiversity survey as a friendly competition between cities. Founded in 2016 as a competition between San Francisco and Los Angeles, today the event engages hundreds of cities across the globe, including multiple metro areas in Texas. To facilitate partnerships and collaborations between cities in our metro areas and make boundaries for the event clearer to our event participants, Parks and Wildlife staff encourage using county boundaries to delimit these metro areas. Next slide, please. The event's hosted in iNaturalist, and each city or metro has its own project page to track results. Participants spend 4 days collecting observations and uploading them to the iNaturalist project, and the following 6 days are spent going through the accumulated data and adding identifications. Next slide, please. Roughly 1 month prior to the 2020 City Nature Challenge, we were faced with the challenge of how to safely pivot event programming in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. All of our metros still participated, respecting local regulations and social distancing practices. In-person group events were canceled, and individual or household participation close to home was encouraged. While we expected some engagement, we were impressed with the event turnout, which generated more than 101,000 observations of over 6,400 species made by 4,700 observers and verified by 1,800 identifiers in just 4 days. Next slide, please. In spite of the major challenges imposed by the pandemic, the 2020 event numbers were up statewide in all categories from the previous year, netting an additional 3,000 observations, 100 species, 1,300 observers, and 300 identifiers. Next slide, please. The 30% statewide increase in participants making observations is significant because one of the outcomes we're finding from participation in the City Nature Challenge is that it appears to result in deeper, sustained engagement with iNaturalist and our community science work. Next slide, please. When looking at iNaturalist user activity, we found patterns pointing to increased engagement with iNaturalist and its projects after participation in the City Nature Challenge. The process typically begins when users who have an account but who have only made sporadic observations attend an iNaturalist training workshop. They leave with a greater understanding of the platform and the Nature Tracker program's mission and goals, as well as a call to action to participate in the City Nature Challenge. During the event, some of these users may log a few hundred observations and identifications. What we see afterwards is a much higher and sustained level of engagement with iNaturalists, including sharing observations with our agency's long-term taxonomic projects that feed into the natural diversity database. Some users who may have mobility or access challenges find their niche online in making identifications for others. We also have participants who've become skilled and passionate iNaturalist users and in their turn teach their own workshops, thus further enlarging our core of community scientists. Next slide, please. More than half the data submitted to the City Nature Challenge projects for Texas last year were designated as research-grade quality in iNaturalist, marking them as high-quality, robust data that we have a high level of confidence in. Research-grade in iNaturalist refers to observations that are of wild organisms with photo or sound vouchers that are of a quality to merit a species-level identification by the majority of identifiers who look at the observation. This designation is also one of the necessary baselines for inclusion in the natural diversity database. Next slide, please. Data generated for the City Nature Challenge and other iNaturalist projects are also used to support local conservation work. In some places, these projects document biodiversity in parks and open spaces that have been overlooked, filling data gaps and informing habitat management and restoration work. These data are also used to make recommendations for protecting natural resources in the process of planning energy projects, transportation corridors, and land acquisition. The City Nature Challenge has also been a powerful tool for fostering local partnerships and collaboration among municipalities, community groups, and the agency. And through this event, many of our partners are able to engage historically underserved communities with the nature around them. Next slide, please. Some of the most valuable data generated during the City Nature Challenge relates to rare species. In 2020, observers logged over 1,700 research-grade observations of 123 species of greatest conservation need across participating project areas. These observations provide valuable information about where and when our most at-risk species have been documented in our most developed and rapidly changing counties in the state, which can inform conservation and land use planning locally and at a landscape scale. These observations are also the ones with the greatest potential for inclusion in the natural diversity database. Next slide, please. In 2019, the City Nature Challenge uncovered a previously unknown population of a rare Texas plant in Dallas County when a rare plant botanist with the Botanical Research Institute of Texas identified an iNaturalist observation as Engelmann's bladder pod. Found in limestone prairies from southern Oklahoma to central Texas, this plant historically occurred in several areas in Dallas, but prior to this discovery, only one population was believed to remain, making this record significant for the conservation of this rare species. Next slide, please. As we grow community science participation, we are creating a network of eyes and ears on the ground that can support agency biologists. In the nine-county Houston-Galveston area, the 2020 City Nature Challenge observers outnumbered Texas Parks and Wildlife biologists in the area 84-1. When posed with unique opportunities like documenting the impact of February's winter storm Barry on wildlife mortality, we put out the call for observations and we have a network that responded. In 1 week, over 640 community scientists submitted over 2,700 observations to our winter storm project, enabling us to collect data on a scale beyond what staff alone could manage. Next slide, please. While the pandemic posed a considerable challenge to our work this past year, what we saw in the City Nature Challenge numbers and statistics mirrors the reports, anecdotes, and stories of people rediscovering nature right outside their doors. Texans place a high value on contact with nature and time outdoors. We saw sustained and indeed expanded participation in the City Nature Challenge in community science over the past year. People contributed to our projects even when restricted in their travel and remained dedicated to sharing their observations with us. Their data document biodiversity in and around our cities at a scale the agency and our partners alone cannot achieve. and these volunteers who participate in the City Nature Challenge often stay with us for more than the 4 days of the event. They begin to engage with us, they stick with it, and as they do, they're developing into committed community scientists. Next slide, please. The 2021 City Nature Challenge is coming up soon. Observations will run from Friday, April 30th through Monday, May 3rd, with identifications wrapping on Sunday, May 9th. Even though observations need to come from specific areas, we promote participation across the state as people can make identifications from anywhere. More information about the event and detailed results from previous years are available on the agency's website. Next slide, please. And the scope of the event continues to grow. We had 8 projects in 7 major metro areas covering 45 counties in 2020. Next slide, please. And in 2021, that number has increased substantially as we welcome 6 new project areas, bringing the number of participating areas to 14, covering 78, or nearly 30%, of the state's counties. We're looking forward to seeing what our network of community scientists finds this year. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. That's fascinating. It always amazes me, Carter, how much goes on around here that we don't really know about. So thank you. It's fascinating. Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, I did.
Yes, Commissioner Bell.
I find this just very interesting, very fascinating. How many of the and I like the last slide where you talked about the expansion to the additional counties. And since we're doing it by county, I'm looking at the map. What's your sense of maybe smaller and rural counties coming online having an interest? Because a lot of people are outdoorsmen in those counties. How do we get the message out to them? And I've just loaded the app on my phone. So,
fabulous. So one thing that did not make it into the slides that was a fairly recent addition was that this year the global organizers for the whole project planet-wide have actually opened up a project that is open to anyone anywhere. So you do not have to be in one of the participating project areas anywhere you are, and that includes all the rest of our Texas counties. There is a specific project for people to be able to join, and if they want to get involved in this event, they are welcome to submit their observations to that particular project to be counted. But certainly, when we go out and promote the work that we do, we are really asking people to be thinking about the nature that they can observe wherever they are, whether that is outside their door, whether that's on a trip out to a state park or WMA, or just even driving down the road if they happen to see something that looks interesting, if they're able to safely document it. All of that is data that we encourage that people try to share with us.
Thank you.
Again, thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Doctor. That's wonderful. All right, at this point, Mr. Wolf, Carter, this commission has completed its business, and I declare it adjourned at 11:20 p.m.